Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Julian Chang, and I'm the co-chair of the LGBT member-led forum here at the Commonwealth Club. It is our distinct pleasure and honor to present tonight's program in the context of our platform series in the month of August, dealing with all aspects of work. When we first conceived of this program with Andrea Shorter, tonight's moderator, we looked at work from an unconventional point of view, work as being something that you are devoted to in your life, in addition to what you do for a paycheck, how you devote your personal resources of time, talent, and intelligence. I can think of no better way than to explore the life of Bayard Rustin tonight. So without further ado, let me welcome all of you who are here for the first time to the Commonwealth Club. And for those who are returning, we hope you come back many more times. Our program is available on our website 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, www.commonwealthclub.org. You'll see a list of programs that are upcoming. We have another program on Thursday night featuring David Perry. In October, we have a program on gay Mormons that are working for marriage equality. And in November, right before World AIDS Day, we have another program on Truvada, the promise of a pill preventing HIV. But now to tonight's fantastic program. Our two guests are luminaries in their own right, Andrea Shorter and Michael Long. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Andrea Shorter. A keen admirer of Bayard Rustin's history and legacy, Andrea Shorter is the co-founder and co-chair of the Bayard Rustin LGBT Coalition, a Bay Area political forum dedicated to advancing the interests and developing the political empowerment of African-American LGBT people. She is the former director of And Marriage for All, a public education campaign of the coalition, outreaching to African-Americans on the importance of same-sex marriage as a civil right, as well as being a well-regarded strategist on building coalitions between LGBT movements and diverse communities. A longtime advocate of LGBT civil rights, Andrea serves on the boards of directors of the Alice B. Toklas LGBT Democratic Club and the San Francisco LGBT Community Center. She currently serves as a senior ranking member of the Commission on the Status of Women. A David Bonnet Leadership Fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, Andrea is also the CEO of Atlas Leadership Strategies, a hybrid firm specializing in political leadership coaching and strategies to engage, develop, and hone the leadership skills of and retain women, people of color, and LGBT people in public service. Andrea has appeared in numerous media, including the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, The Nation, PBS, the Huffington Post, public radio, various blogs, and on all major television networks and news outlets regarding civic engagement, civil rights movement, gender, and LGBT equality. Please welcome Andrea Shorter.
Thank you so much to Julian. He has just been an absolute pleasure to work with in pulling this program together at the Commonwealth Club. Again, welcome to everyone. I also want to give thanks to our other co-sponsors of this evening's program, the Bayard Rustin LGBT Coalition and the Alice B. Toklas Democratic Club, the oldest Democratic club of LGBT people in this country, City Lights Bookstore, and also certainly I'm proud to co-sponsor as Atlas Leadership Strategies. Join me also in welcoming our special guest of honor here, which is Michael Long. And Michael Long is an associate professor of religious studies and peace and conflict studies at Elizabethtown College, and is the author or editor of several books on civil rights, religion, and politics in mid-century America, including Marshaling Justice, the early civil rights letters of Thurgood Marshall, and First Class Citizenship, the Civil Rights Letters of Jackie Robinson. He holds a PhD from Emory University in Atlanta and resides in Highland Park, Pennsylvania. His books have also been featured or reviewed in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, USA Today, Book Forum, Ebony Jet, and many other newspapers and journals. Michael has appeared on C-SPAN and NPR and has speaking engagements that have taken him from the National Archives in Washington, D.C., to the Houston Public Library, and to the City Club of San Diego and the Metropolitan Club in New York City. Please join me in welcoming Michael Long. Welcome back to San Francisco.
Thank you, Audrey. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah, well, great to have you. So, Michael, we're here today because you have recently released a wonderful book that you have edited regarding Bayard Rustin, and it's I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life and Letters. And as has been noted before, many of us here today are big fans of Bayard Rustin. This year marks the 100th anniversary of his birth. And so a number of us, certainly here in San Francisco and the Bay Area, have been in one way or another celebrating Bayard Rustin's birthday. He would have been 100 years old in this year. This also marks the 49th anniversary of the March on Washington for Freedom, for Jobs and Freedom, which is actually next Wednesday or next week on the 28th. And so we know that most people, if they're familiar with Bayard Rustin, associate him with that March on Washington that occurred in 1963. And you and I, we were discussing earlier how it seems like there's a perennial reintroduction and renaissance around Bayard Rustin. He's a familiar figure in relationship to civil rights, human rights, LGBT, labor movement, but in particular civil rights, as it pertains to his role in organizing the March on Washington. But beyond that, people may not be as familiar with him. And he was a gay African-American man, and we'll talk a bit about that. But, you know, he in many respects is a truly transformative figure in the civil rights movement and other movements. How did you come to discover and eventually edit this wonderful compilation of letters about Bayard Rustin?
Bayard kept popping up everywhere in many ways. When I did my dissertation on King, Bayard was there. You can't study King without seeing Bayard almost everywhere. When I did my book on Jackie Robinson, there was Bayard again. 1958, 1959, Bayard enlists Mr. Robinson to take a leading role in the Youth March for Integrated Schools in Washington. And there's Jackie marching in the front of the line, thanks to Bayard. When I studied Thurgood Marshall, there was Bayard yet again. In 1947, Bayard is leading the Journey of Reconciliation. These are the first Freedom Riders before the 1961 Freedom Riders, John Lewis and others. Bayard and others were testing Supreme Court laws through the South with a bus ride. It was a dangerous bus ride. They had asked Thurgood Marshall about the wisdom of undertaking such a ride. And you know what Thurgood said? Don't do it. Now, Thurgood had just almost been lynched in the South, and so he was very concerned about their welfare. And he told Bayard and the others, this a young man at the time named George Hauser, who lives out here in California, still going strong, not to do it. Thurgood was in many ways a conservative voice in the civil rights movement. But when I studied these figures, Martin Luther King Jr. and Jackie Robinson and Thurgood Marshall, Bayard was everywhere. So I decided just to explore him a little bit more. And when I started reading about him, some of you may know, you can't help but get caught by the power of his personality and the historic richness of his work. So those are really the main reasons that drove me to do this collection. Plus, when I started reading the letters, I mean, they are gems. And Bayard gives deep, rich insight into his personality and into his politics, too. So it was a nice combination of politics and personality for me, which I found so compelling.
Right. He was quite a brilliant personality. I mean, this was a man who was very... when he walked in the room, I mean, he wasn't some shrinking violet. He had, you know, quite a personality and quite a presence. And given, again, the relationships that you've mentioned, everywhere that you look, there was you know, Bayard Rustin. What is your theory as to why he may not be more widely known or greatly known, you know, as the figures were that you mentioned? You know, obviously Thurgood Marshall. I mean, that's quite a triumphant figure in history. But nonetheless, some of the other key players that were shaping civil rights. Why wasn't he better known?
A couple of reasons come to mind. A major reason is that Bayard early on wasn't a leader of a traditional civil rights venue. And so he wasn't like Thurgood Marshall or Roy Wilkins at the NAACP, right? He didn't have an organization like that. He wasn't a leader of the National Baptist Convention. He wasn't like Adam Clayton Powell Jr. of Harlem. He wasn't a congressional leader. He wasn't part of the traditional civil rights venues. And so because he wasn't a leader, I think historians have tended to miss him and miss his significance. But I also want to add that Bayard was clearly discriminated against in his life, partly because of his gay sexuality. And I can tell you a little bit about that now if you want me to.
Please do.
In 1960, King and A. Philip Randolph. You all know A. Philip Randolph. He's a great labor leader, Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Wonderful guy. If you don't know him, go look him up. Gem of a man. Bayard enlists King and A. Philip Randolph to have a press conference to announce that they're going to march on the Democrats and the Republicans and that summer to protest for civil rights. It's 1960, right? All right, so Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. of Harlem, congressman there, he's also pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. He gets wind of this, and he doesn't like it for a variety of reasons. And he decides that he's going to put the kibosh on the march on the Democrats. He's a Democrat, right? So what does he do? Well, he has an intermediary call Dr. King with a threat. Dr. King's in South America at this point. And the threat is this. If you don't stop the march on the Democrats, I'm going to go to the media and tell them that you're having a gay affair with Bayard Rustin. It's 1960, right? So Dr. King is normally a profile in courage. Are you with me? But he starts to think, wow, Adam Clayton Powell goes to the media with something like this. By the way, there wasn't a ring of truth to it. I once asked Walter Nagel, who was Bayard's longtime companion in the last 10 years of his life, whether there was any truth to it. And Walter said, please, Dr. King was not Bayard's type. And if you know anything about Dr. King, you may also know that Bayard was not Dr. King's type either. There wasn't any truth to the rumor. But it was dirty politics. And Dr. King assesses the context, and he decides that he's going to cut Bayard Rustin out of the inner circle. There are several maneuvers that happen. But eventually, he gets cut out of the inner circle. Now, who does this? Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. It's an act in many ways of discrimination against Bayard. Up to this point, is it okay if I keep going?
Please do.
Up to this point, Bayard had really engineered much of the construction of Martin Luther King, Jr. He went to Montgomery right at the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott, and he schooled King in Gandhian nonviolence. He built Dr. King his first national platform at the prayer pilgrimage in 1957 in Washington, D.C. He ghostwrote speeches for Dr. King. He ghostwrote articles for Dr. King. He introduced Dr. King to leaders across the country. He had done a lot for Dr. King. 1960, Dr. King cuts him out of the inner circle, and Bayard is absolutely crushed. So I'm telling you this story to let you know that if Dr. King acted with discrimination against Bayard, you can only imagine that others did too. And that's exactly right. It happened to Bayard a lot. He was cast into the shadows of the major leaders of the civil rights movement. And he stayed there willingly sometimes and sometimes not so willingly. But I think because he was in the shadows, Andrea, that's partly why we have missed Bayard through the years, too.
Right. And not just in the civil rights movement itself. He was also somewhat advised by a mentor in the labor rights movement and peace movements that, hey, just kind of tone it down a bit, because he had been arrested a number of times for being basically a gay man, an openly gay man. And so there was some concern as to how that might impact finding out that he had been arrested might impact those movements as well.
Correct? Well, what really dogged him is this 1953 arrest right. in Pasadena, California. Byard had served as a CEO. Byard served a prison sentence during World War II because he refused to serve in the military. Mm-hmm. And after that, he goes back and he works with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He had been employed by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is an interfaith pacifist organization, the major one at this point in U.S. history. So he goes back and works with the FOR. And in 1953, he comes out to Pasadena, California. He gives this rousing speech to university women about world peace. And then around 2:30 a.m., he's wandering the streets of Pasadena. And there's a passing car. A couple guys are in it. You know, they exchange glances. They exchange waves of hand. They pull over. And Byard goes over and talks to them. And he ends up in the front seat with the driver and engages in sex with the man in the front seat. And then he does the same with the other man in the back seat. And as he's doing that in the back seat, he's a busy guy that night. The Pasadena police pull up and arrest him. And he lost his job because of that arrest and others as well that preceded that. And that arrest really dogged him for the rest of his life. In 1963, do you mind if I jump around a little bit?
Sure.
1963, just before the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, Senator Strom Thurmond, you know him? He goes to the well of the Senate floor, and he points his finger. And this is just before the march. And he outs Byard as a gay man. He calls him a sex pervert and a communist. In fact, Byard had been a communist mm-hmm. early on. But he really outs Byard and calls him a sex pervert. And then the media get a hold of this. And this was of major concern to the major civil rights leaders before the March on Washington. They thought something like this might happen. But at this point, they all rally around him, which is a beautiful example of reconciliation among those civil rights leaders who often fought tooth and nail against one another. But at that point, they really did rally. But that 1953 arrest dogged him for quite some time. In fact, the rest of his life, when he would speak after the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the John Birch Society would show up at his speeches and give out his arrest record. He wasn't a fan of the John Birch Society.
Yeah, well, many of us, I think, in this room may not have been either at that time. Letter writing today in this, Twitter world that we exist in, it just seems like such an ancient art form of communicating. And one of the things I've really enjoyed about I Must Resist is really just sort of that the clarity and the critical thinking and deep thought, and also just sort of a really good sense of who this man was. His values and his ability to really be very clear and articulate about what he wanted to transpire in a particular moment in time. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to find the letters and what through the letters really maybe revealed more about Bayard Restner, something different than maybe what you would have expected?
Sure. Well, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI conducted surveillance of Byard's life. That order was signed by Robert F. Kennedy. Robert F. Kennedy was no fan of Byard Rustin. 1963, he's at a party in Georgetown. He walks up to a woman named Marietta Tree and says, I hear you're here for the march with the old fairy, the old black fairy, or something to that effect. Mm. And while we think highly of the Kennedys in many ways, they had some rough goings with African Americans during the Civil Rights era, no doubt about it. And Robert F. Kennedy wasn't a fan of Byard, and he signed off on that order to conduct surveillance. And so at many points, the government acted as an enemy of Byard's willingness and dedication to bringing first-class citizenship to African Americans and indeed everybody. But to this day, or this day, I should say, the Library of Congress has seen the wisdom of Bayard's life, and they recognize him as a U.S. patriot. And they house his letters and a lot of his speeches and essays and articles and documents. And so a lot of his letters are collected at the Library of Congress, the National Archives Manuscript Reading Room in Washington, D.C. And you can go there, and anybody can go there if you're of age, and pull a letter and see Bayard's beautiful handwriting. He didn't type, but you can go there and see his beautiful handwriting. So I got most of the letters there. You can also find them on microfilm. Mm-hmm. But I also consulted with archives across the country. Bayard sent out tons of letters. And you can find those letters in the strangest of archives and in private hands, too. Mm-hmm. His friends are still around. And every now and then somebody will say, hey, I have a letter in my possession. And that's always a beautiful thing to come across. Mm-hmm. But it's so nice to sit down and actually read a letter in somebody's and Bayard's handwriting. It mm-hmm. feels historic. And he's writing, I think, with history in mind sometimes. These are big letters,
right.
As you
yeah.
know.
Yes.
These are really
very
big
lengthy.
Letters. And they reveal his personality in ways that you just don't get by listening to his speeches. And so I'm going to that second part of your question, Andrea.
Right.
One of the things I think that surprised me came up in the prison letters, the letters that he wrote when he was in Ashland and then Lewisburg Federal Prison serving a sentence for not serving in World War II in the military. And some of those letters talk about his struggles with his gay sexuality. And he's wondering, he's met this woman named Helen Whittemore, and she expresses her love for him. And she talks about how they could be together. And that really captures Bayard in many ways. And he struggles with that in his letters, even as he's writing these letters that I'm talking about to his gay lover in New York City. So those letters from prison, I think, are especially revealing.
Right. Yeah. Do you have a favorite letter? And before you respond to that, I just want to remind folks in the audience that if you have questions, I know folks are kind of wanting to be engaged, to make sure that you write them down and Julian will pick them up. Do you have a favorite letter or something that really pops out for you that you continue to meditate on about what this is all about as far as his legacy or...
Sure, I do. I'm turning to page 361 in I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life and Letters, published by City Lights Books. Rustin is writing to a woman named Mary Ann Greenstone. She's a member of the English department at Wayne State University. And she had written him after seeing Bayard on a TV show. And she's writing about how she had some problems and she was getting tired dealing with anti-Semitism. And so she's expressed this in her letter, and Bayard is responding to this concern of hers. And he writes, "Dear Mrs. Greenstone, I am sympathetic to your point of view, but I am not sympathetic to your cry of being tired. Mrs. Greenstone, I'm 59 years old. I am black, and I have lived with and fought racism my entire life. I've been in prison 23 times. Serving 28 months in a federal penitentiary and 30 days on the North Carolina chain gang, among other punishments. I have seen periods of progress followed by reaction. I have seen the hopes and aspirations of Negroes rise during World War II, only to be smashed during the Eisenhower years. I'm seeing the victories of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations destroyed by Richard Nixon. I have seen black young people become more and more bitter. I have seen dope addiction rise in the Negro communities across the country. I've been in a bomb church. My best friends, closest associates, and colleagues in arms have been beaten and assassinated. Yet, to remain human and to fulfill my commitment to a just society, I must continue to fight for the liberation of all. There will be times when each of us will have doubts, but I trust that neither of us will desert our great cause. Sincerely, Bayard Rustin."
Wow.
I love that letter. I still get chills when I read it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't tell you how many times I have read that, and I do read it devotionally. That's interesting you suggest it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do read that letter devotionally. This was an academic study in many ways, but I can tell you that Byard's life is simply inspiring to me as a scholar as well. This is a man who took his convictions and, against all odds, made them come real by helping all of us believe in people power. Mm-hmm. You know, all those marches that have happened since 1963, many of them are traceable to Byard's work in 1963. Marches for women's rights, marches for LGBT rights, marches for immigrants and so forth. And right. There's a model that Byard built for us, and he taught us how to march. He taught us to believe in our power to transform political society and civil right. society at the same time. Right. And so while, you know, this was a study for me, I still get chills when I read some of these letters.
He was sort of the, you know, with all due respect to our president, I mean, he was sort of the predecessor to the idea of real hope and change and how you work for that. Aside from the fact that he was, you know, a gay black man in a time that it wasn't so popular to be either gay or black, let alone both, he was also Quaker, or was raised with Quaker values. And you're coming from Pennsylvania, and clearly that is a hallmark state of the Quaker movement, so to speak. Can you talk a little bit about how he was raised by his grandparents and how his religious values informed the work that he did? Because many people don't see him as sort of a religious person, but clearly as you examine his life and his work, it's hard, at least for me, to divorce what he expresses of his values based in a Quaker tradition. And as a pacifist, ultimately, from the work that he's doing, which at times was a very volatile, very violent world, right? You're talking about the civil rights movement, resisting again, working with King to resist violence, and then into the Vietnam War. And so these are very volatile times. What was that? What's your impression in terms of how Quakerism or his values as a pacifist informed the work that he did?
Well, I think that's a great point, Andrea. I don't think it's possible to understand Byard without understanding that he is a spiritual person. Byard is a political animal to the bone. There's no doubt about it. You look at his work, and you know this guy lives and breathes politics. But driving that is the engine of his spirituality. It really is. He was reared by his grandparents, Julia and Jennifer Rustin, in Westchester, Pennsylvania. His mother, Florence, was a teenager when he was born. His father, Archie Hopkins, was a bit of a hard-partying laborer, and both decided to move on from their roles as parents. His grandparents, beautiful people, Julia and Jennifer, stepped into the vacuum and decided to rear them as their own son. And here's what he learned from Julia. Julia was reared in a home that had deep Quaker values. Her mother was a domestic for wealthy people in Westchester. And some of these wealthy people were Quakers, and they insisted on schooling Julia in the Quaker religion. And they insisted on giving her a good education as well. She came out with nurse's training. But she passes on these Quaker values to Byard. And what are these values? Well, the principles of nonviolence that she believed Jesus taught and lived. Also, the belief in human dignity, and this is what also Byard says, the belief in the human family is one. So he gets these three primary lessons from her. But, and this is what some people miss when we look at Julia, she is also really deeply formed at the same time by the black church in Westchester. She was a member of the AME church. You all know the AME, African Methodist Episcopal.
Absolutely.
Historic black church. Mm-hmm. And she was a member of the AME church in Westchester, and she took the primary lesson from the black church, which is what? Well, it's the story of the Exodus, when God joins with Moses to do what? To set the slaves free. Mm-hmm. When do you set them free? Do you set them free in the by and by? Do you set them free when you get to heaven? No. You set them free right here and right now, right? So she takes these two lessons from the Quakers and from the AME, and she blends them, and she schools Byard as somebody who's committed to setting the slaves free right here and right now, but doing it nonviolently. So these are spiritual values that drive Byard's entire life. Why is he working with FOR, the Fellowship of Reconciliation? Why is he working with King? Why is he working with the NAACP and others? He's doing it because he has these spiritual values that are driving him. And if I can find it. Andrea, why don't you go ahead, and I'm going to look up a letter from his grandmother that I want you all to hear. Okay. In fact, you know I have it right now, if that's all right.
Yeah, please do.
When I saw a picture of Julia, she looked like the mildest, meekest woman that you might imagine. She has this picture of, there's this beautiful picture of her, and there are doves on the on her dress, and she just has a really angelic face. I'm not kidding you. It's beautiful. And here's a letter she wrote to Byard's warden at Lewisburg Prison. I want you to hear this. November 12, 1944, 5. Dear sir, I wish to thank you for the courtesy shown me and my daughter by the guards at Lewisburg. I was glad to see my boy Byard, but feel much concern as he is so frail and thin. Why will they not free those men whose only crime is the wish to be treated as their white brother? I have a son in the South Pacific who has been in the midst of things. I have two grandsons, one still in Germany, one just home from Burma, and one a paratrooper honorably discharged because of an injury to his spine. And what will they get out of this? Probably the last to be hired and the first to be fired. Well, listen, this is the calm, mild, meek woman that I had in mind. Please don't keep Byard until he either loses his life or his reason. You cannot and have no just right to break his will. You can destroy his life or reason. But you know, we have a just God to plead our cause to, and you will be answerable to him. May I visit Byard again next month? it's just priceless. That gives you a really good view into why Byard was Byard Rust. And largely, he was his grandmother's son.
Right.
There you go.
Right. Wow, they were forced to be reckoned with.
No, absolutely.
His grandparents in their own right. Maybe the next book of letters will be based on their correspondence with folks. There's this is a question that, you know, it just begs in this moment. What do you think Byard Rustin's conversation would be with folks today in terms of this, the issues around the jobs and the economy? Clearly, we're in a different place and time. It's a globalized economy, and the engines work a little different than they did in his sort of period of industrial age. We're now in an information age, a technological age. We've got the Occupy movement that has of late. I haven't heard much lately from Occupy, but what do you think his conversation would be or where he would fit into the conversation? And the second part, which really is begged in this moment, is what would he have thought of Barack Obama?
Mm. Well, let me go to the second part first.
I got to ask.
Okay. Byard made this really interesting transition in his life, and he called it from protest to politics. And in the mid-1960s, Byard says, what we have to do as a people sometimes is get out of the streets and go into the quarters of power and rub shoulders and form alliances with these folks who have a lot of money and a lot of power and a lot of influence to help us get what we need. And so, some of you may not like this, but Byard made that transition while some of his friends were marching against the war in Vietnam. He was trying to win things from mainstream Democrats, and he would form alliances not only with pacifists or Democrats opposed to the war, but also those Democrats who favored the war because he believed that they could help him win what the African-American poor whites needed at that time. And so he's fighting the war on poverty by forming alliances with Democrats. He believed that there was a time for civil rights advocates to get their bodies off the streets and into the quarters of power, and also start working toward electoral politics and becoming effective in electoral politics. He was a big fan of the early African Americans who won office during the latter part of his life. And so I think Byard would be absolutely delighted. Well, you know, I always have to say that I can't tell you what Byard would say now, but I can take a guess. I think he'd be absolutely delighted that there's been a shift of some sort towards electoral politics and winning some rights that way. And I think that seeing President Barack Obama in office would be in many ways stunning for him. Now, he was a little bit unsure about Jesse Jackson early on. I can tell you that. He was a big advocate of Al Sharpton early on as well. And the mayor of Cleveland, Mayor Stokes, and the mayor of Philadelphia, Mayor Wilson Good, and many others. So he really favored this move into electoral politics. Now, what about Occupy? You know, Byard was one of the early occupiers. In some ways, he really was. He was initially opposed to the Poor People's Campaign in 1968, but he came around, and he helped organize that Occupy movement when poor folks, whites and blacks and people of all colors, went and built Resurrection City in Washington, D.C. to demand jobs and economic justice. Byard was became an advocate of that later on. And so I think it would be silly to think that while he saw the move into electoral politics as important, that he's going to leave behind occupation politics, because Byard was an occupier. He occupied buses. He occupied restaurants. He occupied Washington, D.C. I think he did have concern about coalition building sometimes. I believe that he was concerned that sometimes when we build coalitions, we lose sight of our main goal. And so I think he was concerned when some of these early coalitions were built that there would be so many goals and so many objectives that your battle would become unwinnable.
Right.
So I think he would encourage us to streamline our objectives, to streamline our goals, come up with a couple that are really doable, realizable in political society, and hammer those rather than have a list of 100 million oppressions that we're trying to win all at once.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I hope that doesn't sound too harsh, but that's the kind of counsel that Byard gave.
No way.
That's the kind of counsel that Byard gave his fellow advocates.
I think that would have been very wise and reasoned counsel, because it worked. It would appear that he was also very gifted at making the connections between disparate groups. In other words, he was very keen in advising Dr. King that, look, we have to make a connection between the plight of black folks and poor white folks.
Right.
And so, and that, from what I have surmised and from the letters that you have compiled, really helped to reshape some of the debate about civil rights moving forward and economic justice.
Wow, absolutely. In 1957, Dr. King's going to the prayer pilgrimage in Washington to give his major speech. And you know what Byard does? He pitches Dr. King to talk about building a coalition between labor and civil rights leaders. This is 1957.
Right.
Byard is an incredibly progressive guy. Byard is constantly pushing economic justice in Dr. King's face. There's no doubt about it. And so I think that in many ways, Byard played a very formative role in Dr. King's life in helping him understand the linkages between racism and economic injustice.
Right.
Now, why is all this clear to Byard? Well, just think about who Byard is, right? He's gay. He's African-American. He's a pacifist. He's a socialist with communist roots. He comes from Westchester. He grew up in a segregated community that didn't have a lot of money. If anybody can understand linkages between oppression, it's Byard Rustin. Why? Because it's there in his cultural identity. No, his cultural identities, right? That's where he sees the linkages. He sees linkages in his own life. And so for those who can't quite grasp the linkages, he takes it upon himself to teach them.
Yeah, he's a multidimensional person who is bearing the brunt of a number of those prejudices and impressions. He worked with, so he is a progressive, and as you were talking earlier about his transition from moving from the streets, from protest to politics, he also had to engage, clearly, not just his progressive-minded folk, but also conservatives as well. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit more about any experiences there that you may recall from the letters in terms of having to work with conservative folks as well, sort of across the aisle, so to speak?
Well, later in his life, I can tell you this, later in his life, Byrd seemed to form alliances and coalitions with people we might consider to be neoconservative now. Maybe, and I don't mean to use that term anachronistically, so my apologies for doing that. But he did form alliances with people who were very, very, very strong on Israel, for example. And he took a lot of heat, I believe in the early 1970s, maybe 1972, for placing an ad in the New York Times, which called for the United States to send military jets to Israel. And that shocked a lot of people.
Right.
Shocked a lot of people. And so there's one example where we may see him reaching across the aisle, so to speak, to individuals we might think that he would not form alliances with. But I can tell you this as well. Jewish folks, huge supporters of the NAACP early on, founders, funders, right? And so active in the civil rights movement. Rabbi Heschel marches side by side with Byrd in civil rights marches. And so he feels as if my Jewish friends have fought for me and I want to fight for them as well. And he comes to feel that Israel in some ways is an oppressed state at this point in his life. And he wants to do what he can to help this oppressed state survive and flourish. Mm-hmm. And so I think those are some of the reasons that might come to fore for that alliance.
Right. He was also very actively engaged in fighting against apartheid in South Africa many years before it became, as precedent and as salient to the world stage in terms of what was going on.
1952. Byrd is leading the fight against apartheid in South Africa, here in the United States, 1952. You know, the ANC starts to protest against the laws there in South Africa. And Byrd and George Hauser, I told you about him before, he's his white colleague, very progressive. They form an organization that's really dedicated to rousing United States citizens in terms of South African apartheid and trying to bring it down. And that's absolutely remarkable, 1952. Well, he continues that concern throughout his whole life. And he devotes a lot of his life to fighting colonialism in Africa. 1959 is a really fascinating story. 1959, he's part of the Sahara Project. The Sahara Project is this whacked out project of pacifists who decide that they're going to invade the Algerian Sahara, right?
Yeah.
They're going to invade the Algerian Sahara to prevent France from building a nuclear weapons testing site and then testing their first nuclear weapon on Algerian soil. Can you believe this? So 1959, Byrd gets this group of pacifists together, and they stage these little border crossings. They always get turned back, but they attract the world's attention to this horrible spectacle of a colonial power, France, detonating its first nuclear bomb on African soil. And damn it if they didn't do that. February 1960, they did exactly that. Mm-hmm. You know, Byrd didn't win that battle, but he made a lot of people think that that was a horrible thing.
Right.
So, yeah, he had Africa on his mind a lot. He wrote these wonderful speeches about Africa, and you can see his handwriting read something like this. Africa is a flame, and he himself is on fire for decolonizing Africa.
Right. Let's go back to the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. And so he's, you know, he's out there in the world. He's in Africa. He's organizing, you know, all sorts of things. He's involved in many movements at once. But clearly, what sort of people seem to crystallize him in that point in history is the March on Washington.
Right.
You had mentioned earlier that, you know, he and King, or King had to distance himself from Byard and say, hey, look, this is not a time. I can't work with you at this point. He left. He was hurt. He left. And he went and did some other work. But tell us a bit about how he then came to reunite with King, because there's a period of time, but then he is more or less producing and organizing, you know, this great, what would become this pinnacle, seminal moment in civil rights history. While a number of people, again, may not have been as familiar with Byard Rustin, for those of us that consider ourselves students, we can't imagine the civil rights movement without him.
Uh-huh.
So how did they come to reunite and create this seminal moment in history?
It's a bit of a complicated story. After he gets cut out of King's inner circle in 1960, he goes and does some pacifist work, and then he forms deep alliances with SNCC. Do you all know what SNCC is? Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And he becomes good friends. He's been good friends with the young kids of SNCC. And he carries out debates with Malcolm X at Howard University and other places. And the SNCC kids are there for the debates as well. And so he's forming alliances with SNCC. And by 1962, Dr. King starts to reintegrate Byard Rustin into the inner circle. He does it partly because of Rustin's alliances with SNCC. And Dr. King believes, so I've heard from Rochelle Horowitz, Byard's one of Byard's best friends, that if he's going to be influential with these kids from SNCC, he really needs Byard's help along the way. So he starts to reintegrate Byard during the Birmingham campaign, for example. Another issue here is that focuses on Dr. King. And Byard once said, I love Dr. King, but, you know, he really could not organize a couple of vampires to go to a bloodbath. Dr. King was the visionary, the dreamer, right? He was the American dreamer. But he didn't have those tactical skills that Byard brought to the table. 1962, 1961, Dr. King's floundering. And he believes that he needs to bring Byard back for his tactical genius as well. So by Birmingham, Byard's coming back into the inner circle again. 1962, he sits down with a man who never deserted him, and that's A. Philip Randolph of Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Byard's mentor. And they're sitting around in Mr. Randolph's office, and Mr. Randolph pitches the idea of another national march. And Byard jumps all over that. And they start to enlist Dr. King and others for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. It's initially planned as the March on Washington for Jobs, and later it's expanded to Freedom. But they had big plans early on. They had planned early on not to just have a rally and speeches, but they planned to have marches. They planned to go to Congress and lobby congressional members and so forth and so on. And the plan kept getting whittled down and whittled down and whittled down. But Byard was the genius behind that. He became known as Mr. March on Washington. That's what A. Philip Randolph called him, Mr. March on Washington. It almost didn't happen because Roy Wilkins of the NAACP decided early on that he was going to oppose Byard's leadership of the march. And he called Byard about this and said, you know, Byard, I'm going to oppose you. You have this 1953 arrest in Pasadena that we talked about, right? You also have roots in communism, and you can be sure that the opponents will use this as fodder against us and try to tank the march, saying that it's tainted by communism, by sex perverts. And indeed, that's what happened when Senator Strom Thurmond came out and pointed his finger and called Byard a sex pervert and communist. But the difference this time is that Dr. King and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and John Lewis, who's always there, and A. Philip Randolph, all of them gather around and give Byard a great big collective hug. And they protect him. And they stand by him. Why? Byard is gifted. he's the one who put the march together, and nobody, it seems, could have done the type of job that he did. They got it together in, what, 6 or 8 weeks?
Yeah.
Busiest period in his life. Can you imagine doing that? How long does it take to plan a wedding? I watch these wedding shows. My God, it takes 5 years. Marty puts together a march on Washington for John
without
Freedom
facts.
In 6 weeks.
I mean, facts is so antiquated. Without
right.
PDAs
yes, right.
or smartphones
yeah, absolutely.
Or Blackberries or anything like that. They were doing with pen and paper and telephones, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
I can talk a little bit about marriage since I just raised that issue. Not that I watch a lot of marriage shows, but I will say this. The last 10 years of his life, Bard was in a committed relationship with Walter Nagel. Walter is still alive, doing very well. He's just a young buck, actually, living in their old apartment in Manhattan in the Chelsea section. It's a beautiful apartment, I think, mm-hmm. in many ways. And Walter did a couple things for Bayard. He gave Bayard his first committed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And Bayard, I believe, said something like this, you know, before I just chased wild sex. and now I've found somebody that I'm in sync with, mm-hmm. that I can share things in common with. And so Walter really gave him that joie de vivre that many of us look for
right.
in life. Walter also encouraged Bayard to speak out on gay rights. Mm-hmm. Up to this point, 1985, Bayard hadn't spoken out on gay rights. 1985, he begins to
right.
because Walter really urges him to do so. He urges Bayard to do so for a couple of reasons. He knew that Bayard would be effective, but that's who Bayard was as well, right? And Bayard begins to do that, and he does it really well. So thanks to Walter Nagel and that long committed relationship they have, Bayard grew quite a bit in those last 10 years. Why didn't he come out before for gay rights? Well, you know, he had been stung so many times before. He was openly gay, right? But still, he had been stung so many times. Plus, he said it to somebody who had written him earlier. He said that, I consider my sexual orientation to be private. So he's from that old school
mm-hmm.
where you considered your sexual orientation to be something that you didn't publicize so much.
Right.
But in 1985, he's on the front line.
He was definitely there and on the front lines and remains really... you know, not only a civil rights icon for students, but also LGBT icon, and that's one of the reasons why we're here today. So along that line, just to sort of bring it back home to the letters, who do you think at this moment in time would be sort of an heir of sorts to the Bayard Rustin brand of organizing, leadership, thinking, or just who out there right now could you observe? Maybe not just a singular person, maybe a movement that really embodies the spirit of Bayard Rustin.
Well, if I could combine Occupy and President Obama, that would be the type of... movement and person that I would have in mind. Bayard respected both, and both of them came together in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And while he emphasized one at a particular point and another at another point, he always held them in tension. And so I don't want to answer the question too flippantly and too simply, but if I could bring those two together, that would be nice somehow. I you can't bring those two together, obviously. But if I could,
yeah.
As well as somebody committed to pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a key point. Bayard struggles with this issue of pacifism in terms of state actions later on in his life, but he's a pacifist to the bone, to the core.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't be president of the United States and be a pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
Can you be a member of Occupy and be a pacifist? Absolutely. And, in fact, I think that's one of the things that Bayard would encourage Occupy to do,
to
fly high that pacifist flag and make sure you're peaceful mm-hmm. as you protest for justice. Because in Bayard's mind, no peace, no justice.
Right. No peace, no justice. He was ultimately not just a pacifist. He was an abolitionist. I mean, mm-hmm. that's really at the heart, mm-hmm. it seems, of what he was about, raised from a Quaker tradition. Here's a question. What would be the top economic or jobs issues that you think that he would be focused on for today?
I wish I could answer that, Andrea. I really don't think I can. I think that's beyond my abilities. Yeah. I can tell you that he was very, very, very interested in black trade unionists. Mm-hmm. And those were his passion. And he wanted to organize them, mm-hmm. and keep them together and have them win economic justice in ways that they just still haven't, mm-hmm. won economic justice. But trade unions were really his love. And so he was always an advocate for those great bodies of trade unionists. I was with some of them in Washington, D.C. A couple of weeks ago. And what a wonderful testament, I think, that Byard has left behind with organizing trade unionists. So I think his focus would be there. I really do. Right. I think he'd struggle with automation and globalization and its effect on trade unionists.
Right.
But there's no way that Byard would desert that group.
Right.
He would find out creative ways to make them survive and flourish.
Right. It would also appear similar to what you were saying before, again, making those connections between movements or disparate groups, the civil rights movement with labor. It's interesting how the labor movement has also expanded a bit to also include more of the LGBT movement. Mm-hmm. So he would have been right on time, and I'm sure right on point, in terms of helping to shape, the labor movement to be more inclusive than it might have been in the 40s and the 50s.
I think that's a great point. And Byard certainly moved in the inner circles of the labor movement, friends with Ruther Wright, friends with Meany, friends with top labor leaders. And certainly his mentor, again, was A. Philip Randolph,
right,
who was there pounding the gavel and pounding his shoe, demanding that labor make space for African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Meany didn't like that all the time, but A. Philip Randolph did that better than anybody else, and Byard always looked up to A. Philip Randolph, calling him Mr. Randolph his entire life.
Right. Well, it's a wonderful compilation, and I certainly encourage those that have not read I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life and Letters, to read it, get it soon, because it's just incredibly just a rich experience to read these letters and get a better sense of who this man was about. Out of the letters and of the research that you've done, do you have any sense of maybe what he might have regretted that he was not able to accomplish by the time his days ended?
One of the interesting things I believe that he regretted was was the way he reacted in World War II. And I believe that he came to regret a bit that he didn't do more things to fight what he considered to be the evils of Hitler and his regime. Mm. I think he came to believe as well that he didn't do enough to fight for his Jewish brothers and sisters in World War II. And that while he carried out important work in the prison, and he tried to desegregate the federal prison system. You know, he had big plans. Mm-hmm. While he did that, and he did important work there, I believe he did regret not doing enough to stand with his Jewish brothers and sisters during the evils of Hitler and World War II. In fact, some suggest that that's why he ended up encouraging the sale of military jets to Israel, partly as
Well, we thank you immensely for being here with us tonight, and I think that actually is going to conclude our program for the evening.
And you have been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guests tonight have been Michael Long and Andrea Shorter. My personal thanks to you, Andrea and Michael, for leading us in a fascinating and very worthwhile discussion tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating 109 years of bringing public debate and truth to the world, is over.
Thank you. Good work.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed
it. Talk to you all day.